CTSNet friends, my name's Joel Dunning here with another episode of the CTSNet Beat. We have a very special edition because there has been a huge big article in the New York Times all about a FDA recall of Impella. This is big news, big implications for our whole specialty, so we have invited Ashraf Abu Elia, an expert in heart failure, to tell us all about that. Also this week we have guidelines on carotid artery disease, guidelines on the definition of a perioperative MI, very helpful for all of us, and three fabulous videos, beautiful Lima to LAD, beautiful masterclass of CABG from the world's best surgeons, and a really clever, amazing cone repair for tricuspid endocarditis using a patient's own tissue. Really great edition this week, so tune in for the full edition of the CTSNet Beat. So the big news that really broke this week was that the FDA issued a recall notice of the Biomed Impella. Abiomed is owned by Johnson & Johnson. These have been used a huge amount of time, 65,000 times worldwide, and there has been a recall notice, or is it a recall notice? Anyway, we thought that I don't know enough about this. We needed a world expert, so we have invited Ashraf Abu Elia, who is a senior staff surgeon at Henry Ford Health System, Detroit, Michigan, to tell us all about this big new issue in the world of heart failure with these Abiomed Impella devices. So we'll hand right over to him and we'll see what he says about this issue.
Hello, welcome to this very special section of the podcast. My name is Joel Dunning, but the special bit is that we've been joined by an extremely special guest, Ashraf Abu Elia. Thank you so much for joining us. You are a very senior surgeon and cardiac surgeon at the Henry Ford Health System, Detroit, Michigan, and you have a particular expertise in heart failure management and, the reason we're here today, the Impella devices. Now, for those of you who haven't heard, check out the CTSNet website. We've got all the breaking news about the New York Times article, which covers the FDA recall notice about impellers. Just on first read, your eyes pop out. I mean, you would never use these things again. While they've been used over 300,000 times, 129 patients have had life-threatening complications with left ventricular perforation. The New York Times then goes on to accuse the company, which is owned by Johnson & Johnson, of pumping huge amounts of money into the industry to keep it going with very little evidence. You know, I'm sure our patients would be absolutely alarmed by this, which is why we thought we'd come to you, Ashraf, because we need to get a bit of context into this. We need to know what's really happening. Is this going to be ripped off the market, or are we still safe to use them? So thank you so much for joining us, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this article.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm a very big fan of all your discussions and of all the content of the CTSNet, because it's disseminating education and science of cardiac surgery all over the world. So kudos to CTSNet for all the efforts done to do that. So thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm a cardiac surgeon in Michigan in the United States. I specialize in heart failure surgery, and I do a lot of temporary mechanical circulatory support, so I feel comfortable commenting on the subject. Initially, I wanted to touch base on the recall. What happened? Why is this recall? What did the FDA or the company issue a class one recall on the device? I'll start by speaking about the subject of discussion, which is the Impella device. The Impella device is an axial flow pump. The FDA calls it non-roller left side heart support. And it is essentially a catheter that has an axial flow pump inside with an inlet that sits inside the left ventricle and an outlet above the aortic valve, hence burgeoning blood forward, decreasing the left ventricular end diastolic pressure, improving the endocardial coronary blood flow, improving the cardiac output, and improving the blood pressure. Those devices are usually placed in very sick patients, which is relevant to this discussion. They are all cardiogenic shock patients who are in severe cardiogenic shock, where pharmacologic support did not suffice, and also other mechanical support like an intra-aortic balloon did not suffice. I want to make a comment in this area. Some of the literature would say, oh, intra-aortic balloon does not improve survival. But if you ask any cardiac surgeon in the country, everybody have placed this in an acute situation where patients were decompensating and it did save their life. But it's very, very hard to capture this data. As you mentioned, A-Biomed have started placing those devices starting in 2008. And recently, in November of 22, it was acquired by Johnson & Johnson. Now, what is first question is we answered is, what's this bump? So we described the bump. There is mainly left side support and right side support. I think main of the main cause of the recall was LV perforation. So we're going to focus on the left side support devices. I'm a big fan of their bigger surgically implanted Impella 5.5 because we use it a lot in cardiogenic shock settings and in pre-transplant settings. That helps also patients now get upgraded on the heart transplant waiting list to a class 2. And that gets them usually a heart transplant within 2 to 3 weeks. As you mentioned, there was 129 injuries reported with 49 deaths associated with this device. For a layman to hear that, oh, 50 people died with this device, they would hate this thing. And as you mentioned, they say, oh, I'm not going to want this implanted in me. But in reality, those are really, really life-saving measures that happen in very, very hyper-acute settings. But to put the numbers into perspective, 129 injuries out of 66,390 devices implanted in the US is an incidence of 0.06% incidence of perforation. To take a step back and put it in perspective with the other devices, other intravascular, intracardiac devices implanted, the incidence of perforation with transcatheter valves, the TAVR, is 1.3%, so much higher. Incidence of perforations with TAVRs or CRRT devices is 0.3%. And with PCI, the percutaneous coronary interventions, it's 0.39%. So all in all, risk of perforation is actually low, all things considered with the patient population and all of that. Now, reviewing the data, the company reported that the injuries occurred more with left-sided pumps, more in patients who had acute anterior wall myocardial infarction, those are sicker patient population, and in frail patients, the elderly and females. And also the injuries were reported to have occurred while manipulating the pump, during the implantation, or during repositioning. So to be clear, there was no injuries reported due to device manufacturing or design. I still believe they are good pumps and they save lives. I definitely know they saved a lot of my patients' lives. This was which kind of recall was that? It was a class 1 recall by the FDA. There are three types of recalls by the FDA. Class 1 is when the device can cause any serious injury or illness. And class 2, when it's temporary illness or significant injury. And class 3 is unlikely to cause injury or illness, but it violated the FDA rules. Now, what happened in the recall? Basically, there was no devices removed from the market. So all the products are still available. The recall was essentially an editing of the IFU, the instructions for use for the device, mainly highlighting the risk of perforation and giving more avid instructions to users to use imaging while repositioning the device and exercise extreme caution in hyperacute settings, for instance, where CPR is being performed while you're implanting the device in the cath lab. And the resolution was the change in the IFU highlighting the contraindications of the device and the adverse event. But again, no devices were removed from the market. So this was the part that's related to the FDA.
So maybe if I ask a couple of questions about that. Firstly, I'm from the UK, so I'm wondering what you think the impact of this FDA recall notice will be. Do you think people will be shocked into reducing the use of Impella? I don't think there's any very good alternatives. And then the second thing is, do you think there is an issue with dangerous placement? Do you think there are some poorly trained people out there causing a problem or not at all? So I guess it's, will this have an impact, do you think, in the next 6 months? And do you think there's a real issue here or not?
I think this would be a segue to the next part of the discussion. But for the bigger devices, the Impella 5.5 that can flow up to 5.5 liters, essentially replacing the patient's cardiac output, those devices are placed only when we don't have any other alternative. So I don't think the rate of implanting those devices will change. This also is placed in can be placed only by surgical implantation, unless you have a very aggressive cardiologist who does like transcaval access to the aorta, which I'm not a big fan of, and it's rarely used. So it's used in less acute settings. So somebody with chronic congestive heart failure is falling off the cliff, and we're trying to do temporary mechanical support as a bridge to transplantation or bridge to recovery. So the patient has to be stable enough to go to the OR to have the procedure done in a semi-elective setting. So that's more controlled environment than the hyper-acute setting that's happening in the cath lab when somebody presents with an acute myocardial infarction and the interventional cardiologist is looking for some sort of support to do some to have some kind of protection while they are opening their coronaries or doing a PCI procedure.
So I guess, the other thing that was just really stood out in the New York Times article about this, firstly, it looked like it being hugely critical, trying to put it out as a total whitewash. They said, they're updating a 250-page leaflet to add a little tiny section, basically trying to imply that us doctors are pushing it under the carpet. And then they were tremendously critical about two things. One was the evidence, saying they didn't feel the evidence was up to it with these pumps. And then they were very critical about the fact that Johnson & Johnson are giving $4 million a year in grants to people like you and spending huge amounts of money on basically pushing it, and you get $70,000 per implant as a hospital, basically implying the whole thing was a scam. I mean, how should we as clinicians fight against this, and do you think this would have a big impact again?
Well, I read with great interest the New York Times article by Christina Jewett, and I think there was a good point writing the article. I do think it used some abrasive language for the manufacturer, but I think it also brought good points to light that we cannot turn our face away from some factual numbers. But also, if you reflect on that and the bigger picture of things, the relation between the industry and the medical professionals in the U.S., that also can put things more into perspective. You ask a great question, again, about the benefit, the same comment about like intra-aortic balloons not having data supporting that they increase the survival. Using those impellers also happen in a hyperacute setting that's very hard to capture data saying that this patient was about to die. And how you capture that and compare it to the outcomes. But there has been recent publications, but unfortunately, some of them are linked to people who reported significant financial disclosure with the coming. So that also takes us to the next point. So one great point that the FDA mentioned and the article also mentioned is the company should have notified the FDA about the first complication maybe 2 years before the FDA notified the company to take action. And I think there is a lot to be said about that. I think there has to be some transparency. We shouldn't shy away from complications. And if it's reportable to the FDA, people should be proactive about reporting it. The other point that I think the article didn't do fair for the a life-saving device is reporting the incidence of the complication being 0.06%, which is very relatively low compared to any intravascular intracardiac procedures that are being performed. For innovation to happen, there has to be some degree of risk. And also in the era of capitalism, without having profit, nobody will have a drive to innovate or invent anything else. There is a very fine line between the financial support being legal and being ethical. When I got invited to this talk, I took the time to research also the financial conflict of interest in the U.S. in general. And I came across three very interesting articles, one from Yale that reported that the industry support for research has increased from 32% to 62% recently. Also, I have to raise my hat to the CMS for implying the Sunshine Act back in August of 2003, where basically everybody was obliged to report any money they're receiving from the industry in a very transparent fashion. I also came across a JAMA paper that found that 86% of guideline authors had declared financial conflict of interest, mainly in research payments. There is also a nice article in the Baylor Medical Journal quoting that 80% of US-based medical doctors who lead medical institutions had financial relationship with the industry. And I don't think there is any shame of that as long as it's disclosed and as long as the authorities to be are keeping an eye what's a reasonable amount of financial disclosure. And for information also, people are obliged to report a significant financial conflict of interest when they're receiving more than $25,000 per year from the company, from the industry.
No, I really agree with you that, you know, things like this in papers, you know, extremely unhealthy for our profession. And I don't think the pharmaceutical and medical device companies get enough accolade for the vast amounts of money they invest in incredible drugs and devices, including brand new immunotherapies and brand new devices. So you're totally right that they're a vital part of our system. And just moving on slightly, I wonder what you think the current state of the FDA is at the moment. I seem many years ago, we felt that TAVR was very slow at coming into the American market. I think just this year, they've just approved a transcatheter tricuspid valve extremely soon without any evidence. So it seems to swing one way and another. But just as a practicing surgeon in the USA, what do you think? Where are we at with the FDA at the moment and approval in America?
Historically, there was a lot of scrutiny from the FDA for any emerging device. And that was to protect the public. But also it was a double-edged sword. Some new technologies that were really beneficial to patients would take up to 10 years till it sees the light and becomes commercial. They had to go through FDA trials and extended trials and post-market trials till it's proven to the FDA that it's safe. But the FDA had recently reformed that process to have a more accelerated pathway for life-changing therapies. One of them is actually related to the Impella. During the COVID times, a lot of people went on ECMO. At one point, I had 16 patients on ECMO and one institution, and then this was really hefty to take care of. But they all suffered the problem. As you know, ECMO can increase the LVEDB, the end-diastolic pressure in the left ventricle. And one strategy for venting is to place an Impella device in a setup called ECPella, so ECMO with an Impella. So the FDA granted them an emergency use authorization for venting the left ventricle during the COVID times. And by the way, this indication was just eliminated with this recent recall because it got FDA approved for other indications. So I think it's getting better. To answer your question, I think the FDA regulations to approve newer devices is getting better over time, for sure. And I applaud the FDA on their efforts to improve this process. Now, that takes us also to the next point. There are, they say there are three sides for the coin, heads and tails and standing. Because if you put yourself on the, like say, I now have an idea that's innovative, that's really life-saving, and I want to develop it. What hurdles am I going to come through? I need money to develop it. I need places, I need patient population, I need an institution. But really money is driving whether you can make things happen or no. And that comes to the sensitive subject of industry funding for research, whether it's driving and it's a beneficial thing for the public, or whether there is some financial bias for people to use one thing more than the other because they're receiving some reimbursement or compensation from the industry. Now, are people receiving a compensation from the industry? I'm not a financial guy, but I wrote some notes here about what I found out researching that. And I went to the CMS Open Payments, and it says that in 2022, the total US dollar amount that was paid by the industry was $12.8 billion with a B. So I found the number astonishing for me. It was paid to 600,000 physicians, 2.4 of that, and the teaching hospitals received 1 billion of that. Now let's narrow it down to the subject of discussion today. If you look at what kind of numbers were paid, and this is really publicly available data on the CMS Open Payments website. It says that Abiomed had paid in 2022 $6.3 million, $3.7 million were general payments, and $5 million were towards research, and $10.6 million were honoraria, quote-unquote, and $9.6 million for consulting. Now, in November 22, Johnson & Johnson had acquired the company, Abiomed, but they kept the name of the manufacturer as a company inside a company, if you will. But to put that in perspective, comparing in 2022, $6.3 million to what Johnson & Johnson, now the mother company, it had paid $218,000. So big differential. If you also go to the CMS on payment, you'll find more than $10 million in honoraria, about another $10 million in consulting fees and other details. But there are certain individuals that got paid large amounts of money, approaching $6 million.
Well, that's an amazing insight, world of impellers. Thank you so much for coming to talk to us here at CTSNet. Obviously, having your amazing knowledge of it is fantastic, but also opening the lid on, you know, that those incredible payment systems is so helpful to see. So for myself, Joel Dunning, and everybody here at CTSNet, thank you very much. I hope other people will post some comments and some thoughts, and let's see what happens with impellers. So Ashraf Abu Elia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So thank you so much, Ashraf Abu Elia, for joining us to tell us all about this super important issue. We have lots of other things for you on the website this week, though. So there's quite a lot going on apart from this. And there are two really big guidelines out this week that you might want to take a look at. The first one is by the wonderful Mario Gaudino, Sigrid Sander, and everybody else at EACTS. So Jennifer Lawton, Milan Milosevic running the guideline committee, of course, Patrick Myers, president of CTSNet, and Secretary General John Puskas, Stephen Freems. There are some really, really big names on this guideline. What's the guideline about? Well, the guideline is perioperative MI after cardiac surgery, a consensus statement. Now, why is this important? Well, it's important because a whole load of comparative studies and RCTs of US versus PCI have put the definition of perioperative MI far too liberally in cardiac surgery. So personally, I think they cheat, and I think a lot of us agree. If they put a troponin in at a certain level, they know that a cardiac surgery patient's going to rise their troponin higher than a PCI patient. So they can define a load of perioperative MI in the cardiac surgery group and not in the PCI group, which makes the MACE of one versus the other extremely different when it's driven by perioperative MI, and yet that might make no difference whatsoever to the patient, because cardiac surgery, as we all know, you're going to have your troponins raised further by just being on bypass or having some plegia and things like that. So this is a really, really welcome guideline. It is so comprehensive. They have done a super, super duper awesome job, I have to say, because it's so meticulous, it's really detailed, and yet there's a really nice diagram graphic of what the definition is. So if you just want to dip in and see what the definition is, so that maybe for your patients you could just start measuring it, then that's great. But if you really, really want to get into the weeds of it and find out how they came to the decisions, or maybe your cardiologists want to try and shoot it down, then they provide phenomenally strong support, especially with a recent trial that gives really good support for their definition of an perioperative MI that causes harm, which is what they've gone for. So basically, they've raised the highly sensitive troponin level a lot to define a perioperative MI, much, much higher than all the other studies. So it's going to be a real help for our whole community. Well done. Congratulations. Smashed it out the park, guys, as always. EACTS, again, doing a great job of guidelines for us all. The second guideline is also enormous. This is the European Society for Vascular Surgery, ESVS, 2023 Clinical Practice Guideline on the Management of Atherosclerotic Carotid and Vertebral Artery Disease. So carotids and what to do with them. This is a vascular surgery group, so I don't know them quite as well, but they're clearly extremely meticulous. This is a whopper of a guideline with over 115 different guidelines, way over 100 pages. I mean, it is enormous. I will put my hand up. I have not read the whole thing, but it really is a tome of everything you need to know about carotid artery disease and how to treat it. I guess going through some of it. It does definitions, it does what is a stroke, the etiologies, but it goes into lots of things about cardiac surgery and stroke and cardiac surgery and carotid artery disease and how to treat it, when to treat it, stenting versus open surgery, imaging, like everything. There's literally nothing left out of this guideline. So really, really good. It's an update from a six-year-old guideline where that was meticulous as well. It gives a nice update of sort of what the changes are if you just want to dip into that. But if you even just want to know what to do with your cardiac surgery patients about carotid scanning. So it's got symptomatic and asymptomatic. It makes a very good differentiation between that. Then just dive in, have a look, see what you should be doing imaging-wise for your carotid surgery patients. Should you be doing concomitant carotids and coronary surgery? Have a look at this guideline. On the website this week, we've got three fabulous videos. I have to say a huge thank you to all our submitters. The quality of our videos at the moment is really fantastic. I'm so delighted with everybody worldwide submitting the absolute best of qualities. I've also been talking to people online to solicit some really great videos coming up, so watch out for that. Yusuf, we talked to in India, who's an amazing robotic surgeon who's done over 500 robotic cases. He's going to get a series together. Manisha from the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio is going to do a series on benign esophageal hernias. So there's a huge amount to look forward to coming this summer on the website. But we've got three great videos for you this week. We have a great video from Ahmad Ali Amirgofran. He's a friend of the show. We've talked to him personally online previously, and he does some great, wonderful operations. Now, this one's called Cone Repair for Tricuspid Valve Endocarditis. If you're a general adult cardiac surgeon, then you may not have done or seen a cone repair, but in Epstein's anomaly, so abnormalities with the tricuspid valve, sometimes the septal leaflet isn't there, and they move around the leaflets. So this repair is basically you cut off the anterior leaflet with a bit of annulus, and you cut off the posterior leaflet, and then you shimmy it around the annulus to fill up a hole. So let's say the septal leaflet isn't there, you'll shimmy it around and fill the hole, and then you'll reduce the size of the annulus with an annuloplasty ring and basically make a whole new valve. So you preserve all the cords, which is kind of really clever, and it's your own valve and it should last forever, which is a great idea. So it works really well in pediatric surgery, but Ahmad Ali Amirgofran did it for a very different reason. He had a nasty, horrible endocarditis in a 35-year-old drug abuser, but it was all on the septal leaflet. So he chopped out the septal leaflet, and there he was staring at a super clean annulus and loads of leaflet. And he thought, well, what shall I do? Should we put in a mechanical or a biological valve? Which, you know, that's not great. Lots of prosthetic material. Or shall I just cut off the leaflets, shimmy them around, reduce the size of the annulus, and away we go. And that is what he did. So great video. Check that out on the website right now. The second video we've got is by Tristan Yan, and it's in his series of anaortic off-pump coronary bypass surgery, and it's the LIMIT-LAD. Sit back, relax, to a little bit of music, and watch every single stitch in this very different way of doing a LIMIT-LAD. I certainly never did it this way, because he does a side-to-side anastomosis, leaving a little bit of lima at the tip, and he'll show you at the end why that's a good idea and how it allows you to check beautifully the patency of your anastomosis. And the third video we've got is the world's best series. When I visited the Cleveland Clinic, I was delighted and very pleased to be welcomed so warmly by Faisal Bakin, one of the world's best revascularization surgeons. And he shows us what he does best, which is coronary revascularization. So we do a little interview with him. He has so many different techniques, and he just showed us a very nice, simple on-pump lima to LAD and a graft to the PD with a radial. So, but really nice description. You get to see everything. And so thank you so much to him for allowing us to come to him to video it in person. couple of events coming up for you. EAC's Next Generation webinar is Cardiothoracic Surgery for You, Day in the Life of a Cardiothoracic Resident. That might be quite fun. Thursday, April 25th, open to medical students and trainee doctors. AATS is whizzing up, 27th of April, see you there maybe. And there's an STS workshop on robotic cardiac surgery, 9th to 10th of May in the USA. It's hands-on in person, so you'll have to make the trip. And that's all for this week. Where is Diego? Diego just did his 10 cities in 10 days in China. So to have a rest, he's flown over to India to do some more surgery. Thanks for staying to the end. It was a bit of a longer edition due to our special guest. And I look forward to seeing you next week in the next edition of the CTS NetBeat podcast.